on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply. At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Matt Guru Johnson, how's it going, bro?
Going good, man. How are you doing?
I'm well. So we're on the second season of Ice Water now, and I had to have you on Honey because it worked a few times. But for hearing the story, so remarkable. I thought, listen, people need to know more about who you are and what you've done.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you for having me on and to share my story.
Of course, bro. All right. So for those who don't know, who is Matt Guru Johnson?
Mike Guru Johnson is a husband. Man of faith. I'm an engineer. I'm an executive. Producing background, but now my mainstay is as an executive for Weirdo Workshop.
Okay, so you mentioned engineering production, right? So I'm going to go through some of your credits, right? Just some of them, okay? Mm-hmm. That's Keisha Cole, right? Calling All Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Fantasia's Back to Me record. Rihanna's Russian Roulette. Chrisette Michelle Epiphany. Man, yeah. Disney's Princess and the Frog soundtrack, Never Knew I Needed, Tamia's Beautiful Surprise, Pitbull's Planet Pit, Give Me Everything, Hudson's Why Is It So Hard, what else do we have here? A few Tori Kelly tracks, Leandra Johnson, Lewis York, The Shindellas, K Michelle, and I think I also see The Wailers here.
Mm-hmm.
Let Us See Pieces of Me. So you've worked on all of these tracks. Where does your story begin?
My story begins in Columbus, Mississippi. I've always had a drawing to music as a child. You could say, I think that bug kind of was installed in me from my father. My father was a songwriter, artist, musician himself. He played multiple instruments, played with different bands. So I think that's where, you know, my instinct and draw to music developed from. But first calling was, you know, the marching band. I had an infatuation with the marching band. Say when I was from elementary school to middle school, when I was finally able to try out. And I continued that on through high school. And in high school, I discovered the world of music production. And really, this entire, I don't know what happened exactly, but really my eyes were open to the whole gamut in one year. You know, I don't know exactly what happened, but I've always been interested in the total process of making music and record making and just the whole nine. Not just the creation, the studio recording, producing standpoint on it, but Who I read a lot of credits. Maybe that's what started. Once you start really getting to music, you start buying albums and looking at albums. You start reading credits and start seeing all the different roles and jobs and all the different just the entire ecosystem that comes together to make an album. And I noticed there was an executive producer. There was producers. There was engineers. There was the artists. Didn't know exactly what each of those roles meant, but my first step was to start working on a, you could call it a mixtape album, with a close friend of mine's who were, I think that I had more of the urge to do it than he did, but we were both in a band together, and he was my best friend at the time. And but what our plan was, we were gonna build out. He lived in a actually an antebellum house in Columbus, Mississippi. If you're not sure what an antebellum house is,
Wow, see.
it's a house that was built prior to the Civil War.
Yikes.
So this huge house, it was creepy. I always remember, like, how do you live here? And it was in the middle of the hood too. But
Wow.
he had a large attic where we were planning on like building out a studio in. And the plan was I was going to executive produce his album, he was going to executive produce my album, whatever that meant. So what I took it on as like just, and it's truth of the matter is that's what executive production is. It's part in the investment portion of it, but really just being the key factor in driving of developing and producing the album. Whatever that meant, coming up with the songs, coming up with the song, the sequence. How are we going to record these songs? I saved up money. I had some side hustles in school where I learned how to screw and chop songs early on. I discovered what that was, and as I started like just kind of trying out different softwares and stuff that family members, my uncle, and had old Cubase software, like the first versions and stuff like that. So I'm diving in, learning, getting my own education into DAWs, or which are digital audio workstations, like similar like Pro Tools and what other, Logic, what a lot of people use today, but an older version, very, very older version. But I learned how to slow tracks down, and I learned how to edit them so that they chopped. And so I would make my own like screwed and chopped mixtapes between that and like, everyone loved Capri Suns, selling different things. And throughout school, I saved Capri Suns and chips and Oreos and stuff like that. I saved up money to for studio time. And actually, let me bring it back a little bit. There's a guy that was at my church. That went to my church that started rapping. And I was looking for artists to produce at the time. At this time I started developing tracks and stuff, and I just wanted to make music. Wasn't just whatever that meant, whatever that was, just trying to get something going and started. And I used to sell beats to this guy, and one day he stopped asking me for beats, and I was like, man, hey, what's up, man? I haven't heard from you in a while, And he was like, man, yeah, I end up actually, because he was in this group, that their whole goal was to be like the down south Dipset, basically. It was really inspired by Dipset, and those type of instrumentals. They use a lot of samples, high pitched samples, and stuff like that. And I didn't understand how to make that happen just yet. Kinda, I did, but not. I was still learning I'm still, that sampling is a whole world, that it's a skill set itself, and I'm still learning that skill set per se. And but yeah, he was like, there's this studio downtown, I met this guy that own these couple guys that own the studio, and they're working on a deal with us where they're developers and producers and provide us all the beats and everything. And I was like, wow, what? Really? Here in this small town, Columbus, Mississippi, there's a studio. Like, I didn't realize that there was actually, things like that, which there wasn't really.
Okay.
Like, a couple guys came together and made a studio. You had another guy that was like had a home studio. I came to find out a little later, but there really wasn't as much type of resources there. And but I end up finding where it is, and I found the studio and started booking time there.
Okay.
And when I booked time there, I end up meeting a producer named Big Fruit. A lot of people may not know this guy, but he, let's see, just to give you a little background about him, he's more like, how can I say, he's a hip hop based producer, hip hop and R&B. He doesn't do it anymore, but his at the time he was developing a group. A duo named Cadillac Dunn and J Money.
Okay.
And they were kind of like a regional, back then, it's different times of the music industry. You actually had like it was you could, it was something to have like a regional buzz, and which is still a good thing nowadays, but
So it's different then because of the internet. Well, there was internet back then, but then it was.
wasn't the internet just yet? We're talking about 2002, two thousand, well, 2000,
Wow,
like
yes.
2003, 2000, sometime somewhere between 2003 and 2005, I'll say. But there wasn't really the internet yet. I'm gonna get to that actually, but it wasn't that yet. So you had asked that like it's really more based into the old school. You really need to have a record label, at that point. If you didn't have a record label, you need to have something like an investor that really intended to be a record label and became a record label, and you really need to get a real distribution deal. There's certain channels, certain things and processes that you had to go through to it was closer to the older school of the industry than it is now today, I guess you could say. But he developed a group that had some of a they ended up getting a deal with Asylum, and they had a song called Peanut Butter Inside Peanut Butter and Jelly. Inside Peanut Butter, Outside Jelly. It was something like that. I think it was called Inside Peanut Butter, Outside Jelly, not Peanut Butter and Jelly. But it was a southern hit, and but in ways nationally too, in certain areas. But it was one of my first times really just seeing something like that happen up close. And and I end up staying around because I just booked time there all the time. And I used to just come and hang out because I just wanted to be there and hang out, and I annoyed them. But I built friendships, long lasting friendships through that, And one that took off, they moved to Atlanta,
Hey.
and I was at that point I was actually graduating high school, and well, deciding what I'm doing. I always knew I was going to move to Atlanta before I even knew exactly what I was going to be
Right.
real wise. I knew my goal was like, I'm moving to Atlanta once I graduate high school, and I did. On my 18th birthday, I drove from Columbus, Mississippi to Atlanta, and because I come from a school of, my dad was like, two men, two grown men can't live in the same house. So, I already knew what the business was. But So I st went to school, I studied art audio production at the Art Institute in Atlanta, and I kept in touch with Big Fruit, and my goal at that point was like, I'm gonna be Fruit's personal engineer, and I became Fruit's personal engineer, through that. But actually, just kind of coming around that, Fruit decided to start his own label called FTE, or Family Ties Entertainment. And he had a partner by the name of J.R. McKee, which was kind of at that time, really just one of those guys that had like, an entrepreneurial spirit as well, a hustler spirit as well, and he asked me to come on with them and be their president of the new label. So at that time we had this artist. They found this artist named The Joker. He's a rapper out of Jackson, Mississippi. And our Fruit and JR relocated to Atlanta. Well, JR relocated to Atlanta, and we basically ran set up and ran this out of my bedroom, my apartment bedroom, like I set up a studio, in my bedroom. And they were, really, I think they actually they would come back and forth from Mississippi to Atlanta, and hadn't moved just yet. But this now enters the internet age. At this time you have MySpace, that's kicked off and booming, and you have YouTube. And we spent a lot of time developing this guy, this artist, and achieved a lot. Really did, you can look him up on YouTube. He has millions of views and streams across a lot of his stuff. We had certain goals, and MySpace had charts per city. You can, be top 10 or number one in this city,
I found him on YouTube. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. It's like, his music is that kind of, it's a certain type of southern music, that I think a lot of music today developed from, in a way, it was kind of the early days of it. But we did the hard work to grind, really. I think we had one of the earlier forms of streaming forms, in a sense, because I mean, streaming wasn't around then, but outside of YouTube. But what we did, we used to go to my school at the Art Institute, when like in the late evenings, or and when no one would be in the computer labs or all the different computer rooms, and we'll set up all the computers logged into this profiles, where we might have had a show coming or a new song coming in. Basically, I can't remember exactly how we did it, but we were able to reach more people from being on more computers, or get more tap into more markets at the same time.
Interesting.
Most of More markets at the same time of being on multiple computers or something like that. But yeah, we that end up, long story, fast forwarding that, we end up meeting in a consultant by the name of Skia Fountain, who basically, just consulted us on the label and whatnot. And Skia knew that I was an engineer. He knew I did all of our stuff, and that I was in school for it, and around about, there when it came time for me to where I needed to have an internship, it's probably God ordained in a way, but like a ski ad, you know, I didn't really have to go searching around for an internship. Like he just reached out and asked me, like, hey, I'm gonna be at this new label in this slash studio for Neo. You know, we need an interns. You wanna, you know, come intern with us, you know. So took that up and, you know, began interning at Compound Entertainment in Atlanta.
So you know Brian then?
Say it again.
You know Brian from Compound.
What's his last name? Brian.
Brian, I don't know Brian's. Let's see. Hold on. Let me check this up. Remember.
Wear glasses, kind of stubby.
Yeah, Brian. Yeah.
He does like marketing or
Miller, Brian Miller.
I know Brian.
Yeah, so yes, I used to work with Brian on the Neo content for Grape Juice.
He because he ran Compound social media.
Crazy, tiny world.
That's crazy.
Sorry, carry on, bro.
Wow.
Yeah, see, look at
That is crazy. It's
that.
total connection right back there.
Man.
But yeah, I was one of the studio operations interns, and I around that time, right before then, actually, I had met this guy named Sam Hook, which is a songwriter. Do you know him, Sam Hook?
I've heard of Sam Cooke, yeah, definitely.
I recorded his first song, his first song ever, and that first song, his first song, that first song ended up actually getting a placement through Compound, and him actually, he had a lot to do with that placement, and but it's also became my first placement. So like right as this is happening, this song was being placed, and we both basically kind of came into the Compound fold. Like right about it, that time, and that song was the Jay Holiday, "Forever Ain't Enough."
Crazy. Hold on, so just a minute. Yeah, okay. So you leave your small town, right, to go to Atlanta to go to school and to pursue engineering production, right? And then you work hard and people spot you and they kind of see what you can do. And the next thing you know, you're working in Neo Studio and your first placement is Jay Holiday.
I'm not working in Neo Studio yet. That placement didn't come from Neo Studio. That start the guy at Skia. I had already, you know, I've already worked with him prior before him starting to work at Compound. He had a studio, and that's where I met Sam Hook. And that's when we recorded that song, "Forever Ain't Enough." And but the timing of it happened like on the cusp of us,
Stand.
you know, him asking me if I wanted to come to intern there. And Sam and this song and Compound, all that thing happened at the same time too, basically. And but so yeah, we did that like just as we right before, you know, we were coming into Compound. And yeah, so that was nuts. You know, I was my first actual, you know. You know, major label placement. You know, I had recorded a couple and worked with a, you know, a couple of major artists before, like Nivea. I was actually working with Nivea pretty heavy at that time, right before too. And
Was that through the first studio you're working in Atlanta?
that was with actually working with the skier. So
Wow, okay.
between I might be skipping over something a little bit. Between working with FTE, that was this part where I kind of started you know all in good blood, but kind of just I kind of stepped away from you know stepped down stepped away from FTE
Course.
with Big Fruit and you know and FTE and I started engineering in Skia had a studio in Atlanta, and I basically just started, I was producing and finding some art. I had a group that I was kind of developing, a girl group that I was developing a little bit or trying out, seeing if I really wanted to work with them. And just doing other different things, engineering and producing, just being in the studio, and one of the people I was working with from time to time was Sam Hook and Nivea, but and some other people too. So all of this happened was kind of like a period right before I came on to Compound. I'm probably doing it a little bit still while I was at Compound.
And
But
as this is happening, are you aware of how big this is?
yeah, man. Like, funny enough, like just before I got that call from Askia, I remember watching the Miss Independent video.
Yeah.
I think Neo had just dropped that video, dropped the single had just came out, and like it was the same. It had been the same week, when I got that call,
Wow.
and so I knew definitely I was aware of Compound, because I was aware of a lot of different people, everybody in Atlanta, so definitely I understood, the severity of it, and how huge it was, but just like me, I'm one of those guys. I give my best towards anything that I'm doing, so I came in doing my best, and
Yeah, facts. I hear that. Yeah.
yeah, and so at this time while I'm at Compound, I meet Chuck Harmony.
Okay, I see.
So Chuck Harmony was one of the in-house producers at Compound. And the building that Compound was in was like a loft. Actually, I think Love Renaissance is in that building now. It's like a loft and like a three-story loft kind of thing. And there's a studio on each floor. And the A room studio is on the top floor, and that was pretty much Chuck's studio, and like everybody knew that was Chuck's room, because each producer that was there every day had their own room in the sense that they worked out of. There's another guy named B Major that was on the
Okay.
second floor
Yeah.
as well too. And as an intern, what I never went a bit those kind of those people like, okay, just wait and tell me what to do kind of thing. I'm gonna make sure I'm busy and occupied and apply myself somewhere. So what I used to do was keep Chuck's studio clean. And I just kind of that helped me just stay in there, and really just pick up on how what he was doing. And like I would listen to a lot, I'll be in there while he's making a lot of tracks, and probably never really said much to each other, because especially then, like Chuck's was quiet and I was quiet too, so it wasn't really a whole lot of back and forth talking,
But
until
even now, though, to be honest, yeah, you two have
yeah.
the
The same, still the same, man. It was definitely.
Claude talks a lot. Yeah, Claude talks, but you
Yeah,
and Chuck, very chill.
but one day, it was around Christmas, and I was getting ready to go back home in Mississippi for Christmas,
Right.
and we talked. We were talking like, "Hey, man, what you about to do?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm about to get on the road, head back home." And he was like, "Where's home?" And I was like, "Columbus, Mississippi." He was like, "What, really?" Like, man, I'm from Columbus, Mississippi. Or he said, really, his mother's is from there, like from outside. Columbus is a small town, but then there's like other smaller towns around a small town, And his mother is from one of those small towns called I want to say Clarksville, but that's not it. Hey, let's edit that part out. But his mother's from one of those small towns, you know. And that I think that's what really one of the things that really sparked and started our relationship. You know, that was awesome. I would have never expected that, you know. But I think what kind of really was a part of the process of outside of me kind of already looking after him in the studio, was I mixed. So a lot of people knew me from my mixing skills, and or knew that I was a really good engineer to I'm skipping something again. My bad. Let me rewind. I hope you bring this into some type of DAW and edit it, right?
So normally I don't edit, but I say this though, yeah, only because I think when someone has a story like yours, which is so remarkable, it's tough to think back to everything that you've done. I do the same thing, bro, right? I'm like, oh yeah, I did this in 1 year, and then I've, you know what I'm saying? So honestly, man, it's fine.
Okay. All right. So let's rewind a little bit. There was one on one day. I showed up to my internship, and as I was about to walk out outside of the building, there was like a gate, you know, that you had to, you know, it's like a security gate and stuff like that. And a cab pull up, and getting out of the cab is Claude Kelly.
Easy.
And I definitely had I knew who he was because, you know, actually remember that, you know, during this time and a little bit prior. And mainly prior, I was also producing, and I had a friend that was like my manager at the time that was just trying to get my tracks around to different people, and he's actually like the security guard for Devon Stevens, and Devon Stevens, he's this if you don't know him. Came, you know, legendary guy from the LaFace days, LaFace Records days, on the artist development side, choreography side. But he's also like the business partner of Akon.
Right.
And right at this time is when Claude was working heavy with Akon.
I see.
I had, so he sent. The guy that was managing me, you know, that was Devon's security guard, he sent me some of Claude's. Well, he sent me his MySpace page. He's like, man, you got to check out this guy, Claude. I'm trying to get you some of the tracks to him. And man, I remember when I listened to Claude's MySpace page, man, like, I think there was, I don't think it was the song Over the Edge, but that was on Akon's album. It might have been on his MySpace page, but I remember hearing that and like, I fell in love, man. Like, that because it was so the melodies were so unique and the approach was so unique, but also this the how the song was crafted was so well done too. You know, you had a lot of microwave music in this time.
Yeah, I see.
Microwave for the club, you know, and microwave for, you know, those kind of things and stuff like that. But you know, I could tell that there was definitely some skill set and, you know, some
Musicality.
musicality and, you know, there. And but I, you know, that's when I discovered him, what he does, and I really felt an appreciation of that. So when I saw him pull up on a cab, I'm like, I know who you are, you know. I was, and basically, you know, he walked in with me in the compound, and ended up being that day, Chuck had a session with Claude and with Chrisette Michelle. This is the first day
That's
that
crazy.
they had that session together.
Well, this is
So
insane because knowing how this story goes, the fact that you saw Claude walking into that session, right? And now all three of you have built this company together, man, that's God.
It's amazing. It's amazing, man. It's
Wow.
amazing. So, like that, and the funny thing about that day is, that was the first time, the first day that Compound wanted me to actually run, record, and engineer a, a major, a actual major artist session, and they usually had, they had like a chief engineer that mainly did all of those stuff, but for whichever reason, on this day, they wanted me to do it.
And so to be clear, so with Compound, right?
Yeah.
So was it a okay, so was it was Neo's company, but was it also doing publishing also? So was Chuck signed as a publisher? Sorry, was Chuck signed them on publishing?
Well, yeah, well, not necessarily. There's in a way, there's Compound. It's a production company. They had producers that they represented, and they also and writers and artists,
Right. So
they didn't have a they like a Compound Publishing,
right.
but there were certain publishing deals that basically they worked out for different producers and writers and stuff like that too. So Chuck wasn't, but Chuck's thing there was, like, he was managed by Tashan, which was the COO of Compound, and he was part of the one of the staff producers, basically, and yeah. So on this day, we recorded "Fragile" from the album, and I think they also did another song. I think they did "Bittersweet" that day too, or at least around those, around that same day.
As in by Fantasia.
No, not "Bittersweet." Yeah, my let me rewind. Not "Bittersweet." "Blame It On Me."
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah. So around this time, they had also recorded "Blame It On Me" from Chrisette Michelle. And so a lot of guys had known me for mixing, like Sam Hook, Askia, and a lot of people had, around, in Compound, knew that I had, I could give you a good mix, or at least a good rough mix. And we came from the school of, what you're about to present to the label, you need to get it, you need to present it as close as possible to the final record as as possible. You can't be like, oh, you can't give it half cooked and say that, well, this is gonna happen later. You gotta present the full vision as much as possible you can. And so Chuck asked me to mix a couple songs for him, which was the song "Fragile" we did, "Epiphany," and "Blame It On Me," because he was about to turn those in to the label. And that kind of, I think, is what started our engineering relationship. Well, me, engineering with Chuck. Also, Compound started assigning artists to the producers that they were working with, and I also wanted to be an A&R. Compound had started bringing me into a couple of the, well, Tango, who's Neo's manager, the CEO of Compound, he started bringing me into a couple of their A&R meetings and stuff. And kind of basically started looking after Chuck and his assigned artists.
Okay.
Going so I'm not setting up sessions, but basically I'm going with them to the sessions and making sure everything is taken care of. We got all our files and stuff. Chuck's rigs is set up, and just all those kind of things, getting everything back to a Compound. It's got kind of like some entry level,
Yeah.
stuff. And from at little moving on a little later, there's this point where basically Chuck and I decided, like, hey, we're gonna go out to LA because it's probably more there's more opportunities that we can get involved with from actually being in the city.
Right. And then, what year was this?
I'll say that was 2009.
Okay. Oh, interesting. So, had you met Kerry Hilson at that point?
Yeah, so that Kerry Hilson session was done in LA.
Okay.
A year or two after that.
So, how did you meet Kerry?
Well, that was one of those things where Neo and Chuck wrote, had did the song Pretty Girl Rock,
Yeah.
and it got around to her. They got around to Kerry Hilson.
Oh, interesting. Okay,
And
see.
she was recording it for her album. And she ended up, one day we just, we got a session at Westlake. We worked out of Westlake in LA a lot. And I mean, I don't know exactly how it was placed.
Yeah.
I don't know, possibly, Compound had some involvement with that, but that's how that happened.
So that was a massive hit. I think I remember he sold like 2 million within a few months. That was.
The thing is, I remember that and it's something that's notable about Chuck. And I remember that album, because you got to remember that she was signed to Timbaland and Polo the Don.
Right.
It was kind of like a joint label between Timbaland's, like, was a M Mosley Music Group and like Polo Don Zone 4,
Yeah.
and they've had like a couple of, different singles across both of them, through it. And this is the one that actually really, became her mainstay. And I think that's something that's very notable about, Chuck and Claude have been able to do for a lot of different artists.
Where they take an artist and then give them something fresh that stands out from what they've done before.
Yeah, it becomes their staple song, or it helps establish their career, or helps them have that anchor song for their career.
Anchor, that's a good word for it, actually. And so at this point, Kerry's working through Interscope, right? Okay. All right. So when you engineered that track.
Yep.
So in the session when you were making the track, was there anyone else who you thought could work well on it, or did you always have Kerry in mind?
I think that was always in mind for her. Maybe that was something, it really could have been made for her,
Okay.
because
Oh, I see.
it could have been made for her because that, hey, such and such are working on albums, and people are looking for material. So I think it could have actually been done for her.
So
I
maybe.
know there are some other songs that we've done, or a lot of other songs we've done before that really could have been intended for someone else, but didn't work out and really end up working for someone else.
Right.
But I don't think that was this case. I think it was made for her
Cool.
that really working.
And so when you are achieving the success, right, how is everyone back home responding? So are they seeing what you're doing?
Yeah, like I remember one of the things that was most special to me was actually Pretty Girl Rock. And let me reiterate, like there was a I didn't track her vocal. I more of had engineering credit from the instrumental
Right,
and
of
from the
course, yeah.
sample, for Neo and stuff like that, and other elements that was part of the song. But I remember my sister's niece found out that I recorded when it was a part of a Pretty Girl Rock, and And she was just like, oh man, I love that song. And she was young, you know, she was, I would say she was probably 10, you
Wow.
know, and just how it affected her. And I knew what kind of a quality of the song that was too. That was really special. That was definitely really special. So yeah, it's definitely it started getting out back home, or you know, a lot of different things I was working on, part of, you know.
Okay, so you did Pretty Girl Rock, and you also did Pitbull's Give Me Everything,
Yeah.
featuring Neo. And so with that track, was it a case of Neo having the hook initially and pitching it out to Pitbull? How was the song structured as far as you know?
Well, I remember that day we had a, I just got a call, like, you know, do a session with Neo one night at Westlake again, and I think he wrote that. He usually writes in the studio, so he wrote that in the studio. Like he had the track already, but he wrote that chorus there in the studio, and we recorded Yeah.
Okay, see. Okay, so he made the chorus, and then it was pitched out to people.
No, I think he already, I think it was already coordinated that. I think it was our, well, I don't know exactly how it was coordinated, but I know he had the track already, and the session was booked like this is like a Pitbull session, you know. So I think it was already like an intention that, hey, you know, what you write, you know, all goes well, this is what was going to be on the album. You know, kind of thing. You know what I mean? So he definitely came up with that, like writing, which is a lot of stuff, you know. He comes up with like in the studio like that, you know, right. He sits down and like on a notepad and just sits down and takes the time to write, you know, and yeah, that's how it came out, you know. It's I think it came got a pretty, I won't say it came got too fast, but you know, it came got a pretty fast. Yeah, so that's one of those cases where I think everything was already set up when his Pitbull's label, his team got it back, they loved it enough, you know. I remember another case like that. We were in Miami and you know, the track, what's the name of the song? The Young Money, you know, the Young Money's first single, like the very, very single that had Lloyd on it,
Bedrock.
Bedrock. Yeah, Neo actually did a track that he did a chorus to that prior, and I remember we went down to they had a concert in Miami that night that we went to and went backstage and met everybody and stuff like that and gave them the track and whatnot. And I remember we were in New York another time and Bedrock came on the radio, like, oh, I know this track. That's the song we did. But then the hook came in, like, wait a minute. That's not Neo.
So,
But
how
that's,
does
you know, that's how, huh?
Neo's work of the
Well, that's
different?
just one other. This is how, you know, they it's just how some things can go, you know, like it's placement, you know, it's a finding the right right hook and right, you know, right thing for their, you know, that was really the thing that introduced Young Money, you know, so I'm sure they were going what they felt was the right thing for them for that, you know. So that's just a case of like how some things you can, you know, you can be a part of, or you can have done, but it's not, you know, this is a music business. It's not done until it's done.
Of course. That's interesting because it's true. So you can pitch a track, and in your mind, you're hopeful that it goes to the artist that you've intended it for. But the fact is, you never know.
You never know, man. Like, it could or could not. And
Yeah.
sometimes it can be better than what you
Of
would
course, yeah.
it could be, you know.
Interesting. Okay, so do you still have Neo's version of Bedrock? What was in the Bedrock, but off of that song that became Bedrock?
Nah, I don't think I had it. Yeah.
Okay. That's amazing.
But yeah, that is amazing. It was an awesome experience.
Then you also engineered, I believe, Rihanna's Russian Roulette.
Yes, so that's one of the same scenarios, part of like, just being Chuck's engineer on the track side. But I do remember that. I remember that whole the whole thing. I remember how everything evolved and happened with that track. It was an exciting night at Compound, where everybody was super excited.
Because
When we found out that she was recording the track,
okay.
and when she did it, and everybody waited back on pins and needles in a sense, and to she ended up sending it back. And no, that was an awesome experience seeing it that way too, and also another learning experience because that was all prior to going to LA and everything.
Crazy. And so you cut the original demo for Russian Roulette.
Me,
Was in, sorry, as in vocalist, and who performed the track before it was pitched to Rihanna?
yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. Wow. Okay. And in those sessions, right, when you're working, obviously it's nearest Chuck, it's yourself. So you know that it'll be a good track. But are there moments where you can tell, so are there some songs where you know for a fact? Okay, this is going to be here.
Yeah, man. I mean, it was so different. When I first heard Russian Roulette, I had never heard a song like it. And I still haven't heard many songs like it. That's I think just giving another nod to Chuck. That's the same thing with Pretty Girl Rock. I haven't heard another song like it,
What about
like
him?
And I think it's in Neo, because Neo that took a very charismatic perspective to those approaches. Like it's a great marriage, there. But there's certain things when we don't know exactly how it's gonna take. That sounds awesome. Some things that you resonate with just on a musical level before you even know how much of a commercial effect they will be.
Was
So, on a musical level, an artistic perspective, I thought it was great, pretty amazing, and different. I like the richness it added to her, and I think that's one of the things I think she might appreciate about it also,
that's quite mature.
very mature, and I think it establishes a palette to do more.
Of that sound,
Well,
true.
I think a lot of her more mature things that she's had in her catalog, she's able to kind of go about that from that palette being established with Russian Roulette.
You're right, because when I think of Anti, for example, you can hear how Russian Roulette and those themes on the record in general, but especially Russian Roulette, how you're right, it establishes a baseline to go from being like a teen pop princess to being more out of contemporary.
Right.
And also, that was a, I mean, of course, she was going through a very difficult time at the time, but it was a brave choice because
Yeah, it was.
you have given us towards on Gone Bad, right? But then for them to make that, I think it was the lead single, right? Right.
Was very brave. You gotta give it, I gotta you gotta give it to her. You gotta give it to her team. You gotta give it to Jay Brown and everybody, like the it was a very brave approach. It's very brave approach, number one, because of the circumstances. Her speaking on us, just having some taking some type of level or approach of speaking on the circumstances is very brave, but also artistically, it was brave. But I think it's great A&R, because it's thinking about trajectory more than just also.
Right, trends.
More than trends and more than like what's going to be the fast takeoff. know, like, because like I'm saying, like, it's all about what you're laying into your palate. You know, like, I think it was very, I don't know if it, I don't know if somebody really thought all it saw all of that together, you know, but it was ingenious to really, know, seeing it taking this chance at that time, right then, you know, the timing matter of it was the right thing to do, you know, sonically, right thing to do sonically and musically. And like I said, you know, I think it definitely kind of opens and establishes a palette for a lot of different other types of things that she's done, like that could be more mature or even more rock or even more rock and roll.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then, if I'm correct, you worked with Disney around at the same time.
Yeah. So that this was coming all around about the same time. I think Neo was doing the movie Red Tails at the same time too.
Oh, of course, yeah. Okay.
But yeah, Neo and Chuck went in for the Princess and the Frog and soundtrack and wrote Never Knew I Needed. But yeah, I recorded Neo on that. That's one of those things, you know, kind of same process, you know. You know, Neo kind of like takes time, writes it all out, and then it goes on the mic.
Crazy. And so, okay, so interesting. So, engineer, do you receive publishing on the tracks?
No.
Interesting. So it's like a set, not day rate, but like a set rate, right, for the work on it.
Yeah, it's more like an hourly rate or like a day rate, you know, different things like that. You know, you're as an engineer, you're providing a technical service that it's not a intellectual. You're not necessarily conceiving intellectual property. You
I see. Okay. It's more
know,
so you help facilitate the creation.
yeah, you're helping to facilitate the creation. There's
Yeah.
some engineers that get points,
Okay.
large engineers, like some head, like, you know, really, really heavyweight in like mix engineers. But you know, some guys also may receive things if they're is that's their artist and then, you know, they're playing more of an executive producer role.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, and so you're in LA, and so you're based in Atlanta and you're based in LA, right, during this time.
Well, at this time, well, by the time we started recording Never like the Princesses and the Frog, Princess and the Frog, Never Knew I Needed, and the Pitbull and those things. I'm now in LA. So Chuck and I moved to LA. We set up Harmony House Entertainment, set up a studio, Vanilla Sky. Our goal was basically like, you know, Chuck always had a goal of wanting to realize his musical output in as much medium as he can, or as much through as much media as he can, you know. And that's still the goal, you know. That's one we've achieved that even through today with World Workshop.
Right.
But we still have other goals to reach, you know. But at that point in time, we wanted to find artists for ourselves with Harmony House Entertainment
To build and develop and
to develop, to produce, you know, really get our own distribution deal, you know, the whole nine. We had a certain vision, like say for instance, we thought that there could be there was more to talk about. There's other types of genres and types of artists. We had a list. So like we wanted to, there was the Norah Jones type of artist. We wanted to find a Norah Jones type of artist. You know, we were really into John Mayer, wanted to find that kind of feel, you know. Being open to just different things. But I know I remember those two things were like one of our priorities, you know. We end up finding a group, actually, you know, a girl group, and that we developed and produced, and another couple artists that we, you know, were trying out, you know, to see if they were it or not, you know, or something to work. What I mean by it or not, I mean something well worth investing your time, your resources, your skill set, you know, your energy, your mindset into. That's one of the things with development, it takes all of that. You know, it's a real total investment, you know.
So for
And
those who aren't aware, exactly what is development?
artist development. So artist development meaning you're taking an artist, you're crafting out a sound for them. You're exercising their performance ability, you know, inside and outside of the studio. You're getting them physically and mentally in shape, you know. You're giving them time and process to become more seasoned and to be at. So they can be at their best ability to execute, you know, the career and life that they're, you know, going after.
And so I think, so were you around when Chuck and Claude developed Lewis York?
Yeah, so that's ahead in the future a little bit. But so what happens, Chuck end up started writing songs. Well, he's already wrote songs, you know, and song. You know, he was a part of groups and stuff like that in his past, but in his early days, you know. But he started writing and working on his. Basically, an inspirational project or inspirational album called "Which Way Is Up," and all of my attention and focus went right into him and that, you know. So basically, getting his songs all completed, you know, he recorded them, everything, going through the mix process, getting everything mixed, right, envisioning like the packaging, getting. Coordinating all of the, you know, working with art directors and working with PR people, working with a lot of different people, you know, just trying to get, you know, those the team aligned, the team on aligned and working together towards a common goal of you know, promoting Chuck Harmony. And
See.
that what's happening while we're still in LA, and we ended up. There's this point in time when, while that was happening, kind of simultaneously as that was happening, Chuck became bi-coastal, basically from living in LA, and he also got an apartment in New York. So I live in New York because he wanted to. One of his production goals was to. Basically, just spend as much time with Claude and to write and produce. At the time, he was even sharing Claude's manager.
I
You know what I mean?
see.
The whole goal was basically like to for them to be able to collaborate more. Because Claude was our, you know, from recording Fragile and everything after, you know, Claude's like our favorite number one, you know, songwriter collaborator.
Makes sense, okay.
He, like working on sessions with Claw is what is like, okay, this is why we do it.
Oh,
You
yeah.
know, this is what we're trying to do. You know, it was that kind of thing, you know. And but we end up basically setting up a, well, I and the team, you know, the you know, my our team is working on as far as Harmony House, for Chuck Harmony, end up coordinating like a promo tour, for Chuck, here in Nashville, actually. And
Okay, sweet.
we spent a week here doing a lot of different things, a lot of different performances in different places, meeting people and et cetera. And he ended up getting a deal, like a record deal with E1 at the time,
Okay.
for that and for that album. And one of the first people that outside of that, you know, circle or outside of that, you know, actually showcasing for people and stuff like that, one of the first people that he showed his music for and presented his music for, I remember he went, he showed the whole banner. I had this like album banner made for him, and the CD had CDs pressed up and stuff, and but he had did this whole presentation for Claude and another friend of theirs, ours, named Francesco. Hey, friend. Hey, you might know it from the Friend Zone podcast and a lot of other things. But
Oh, let me open up. Hold sounds familiar. Sorry, carry on,
yeah.
bro.
But anyway, I think that kind of helped inspire Claude a lot too, like more, because Claude has been told by Whitney Houston and a few other like really key people, like, hey man, like you should sing, you should really be an artist, you know. But I think seeing Chuck embrace it and come step in forward of it kind of energized Claude a little bit more. But Lewis York hasn't started just yet. But I think, you know, that's one of the things that kind of helped get the energy going in a
Because
sense,
I
you know.
remember, so I went to LA in for Grammy week and no, Grammy, well, sorry, Grammy period, in January 2014. And hold on a second, I come to the studio, hear some music, right? So I went to the studio and I remember there were a few like serious names there. Yeah, I won't say who, but it's serious. And I remember working and then Jack and Claude were there, and then the artists who they think Claude had signed, who was there as well. Right,
Okay.
and I remember that we played that some of the early Lewis York material, and it was just that, bro, it was like good music, bro. And I remember Claude saying that he wasn't really as in love with LA as he'd been before, so I think I sensed they were going to leave LA and move, I think, to New York, right? I think so, but I knew they were leaving LA. But I
Well,
remember,
Claude never lived in LA yet.
okay.
He was always in New York. Remember, Chuck went to New York and got an apartment in New York to work closer with Claude.
Right, okay. Oh, interesting. Oh, so that's funny. So in my mind, yeah, when he come to the studio, I assumed he lived in LA.
No, he didn't live in. It depends where, if you're, it depends of.
In January to beginning of 2014.
All right, so at that point, he had just moved to LA.
Okay, so brand new friend.
2013, 2014, he had just moved to LA.
Okay, fair.
So what I'm talking about right now with Chuck's album was a little bit earlier. We're talking about like 2011, 2012.
Yeah, I see.
So at that time, actually, when Chuck went to New York a little later on into it, I actually moved to Atlanta for a little bit right in that time. So I was really working this Chuck album in Atlanta.
Right.
But while in Atlanta, let's fast forward to Lewis Short. Chuck and Claude started. That's when the whole, you know, I think after that, you know, right during that time, that's when they actually started forming Lewis Short, because at that time, they had another name. I'm not gonna put the old name out. I know, I was talking, Chuck was talking to me about it and tell me about it. And I remember the first days too. Like, I remember when I came up and I had, and I lit, we actually, Chuck and I was actually working with Tori Kelly out in New York in that time. And I heard the, we did a listening session, one of the early listening sessions for the Masterpiece Theater album, right? EP series. And,
And so at which point did you, okay, so all right, so when Chuck and Claude are in New York, you were in,
Atlanta.
interesting. And then when did you guys move to Nashville to form the Weirdo Workshop?
Was way later.
Okay, I see.
So, but yeah, I remember going up to New York during those Tori Kelly sessions. I memorized the whole album. Like, I could hear the whole album in my head. Like, I got kind of like a photographic song memory like that sometimes. And the let's see. At this point, after this point, let's say after this point, that's when it began to get more serious. Because first, before Weirdo Workshop hadn't been established yet. Lewis York was established, and getting those songs out and all of that started was the start, So, as far as like the Masterpiece Theater album and stuff, and Chuck gave me a call and was like, "Man, we starting this company called Weirdo Workshop, and I want you to be a part of it." And at that moment, that's when the plan came together about going to LA
Okay.
and establishing a basically the creative side in LA. Because what the plan was, like, okay, we're gonna open this up to more artists outside of just ourselves. So anybody else, because there's a certain mentality that went across those songs developing and Lewis York developing. There's a mentality about, thinking differently and taking different approaches musically. And so if there was other artists that was kind of with the same mythology, we would consider bringing those into the Weirdo Workshop fold. So there was a creative A&R-ing thing that was happening in LA when basically I moved back to LA, me and my wife, and we set up like our Claude had a an apartment in Marina Del Rey, and Chuck stayed had a, his own apartment in the same building too. But Claude in Claude's apartment, he had a we set up a basically a studio office kind of thing in the second bedroom. It's like the first Weirdo Workshop where, it's kind of like the Def Jam dorm room kind of thing.
Yeah, and they put it from there. Okay.
Yeah, man, it's and like vision boards and all kind of things all across everywhere and stuff like that and everything. But
Amazing when I think about, I mean, just hearing this, right? And then hearing you discuss the inception and then seeing where it is now. Because, I mean, so to start in an apartment or in LA to now be natural, and have all these artists who are flying into Nashville to work with you guys. You know what I'm saying? It's one thing to if you guys are flying out, but what you guys have in Nashville is so special that artists are flying into work with you guys. That's beautiful.
Yeah, man, that was part of the goal, man. To be us here in Nashville's we wanted to make it like a muscle shows thing, where or like where back where Atlantic Records would bring a Aretha Franklin to Fame Studios, because there's a certain thing that's happening there, a certain sound, a certain exclusion from
Energy,
the
right?
outside world that because it exists, but
So in those cases, for example, like I know, for example, that Kmart show was there for some time, right? And I think Maya was, when people fly down to Nashville to work with you guys, what is it about it? So I know you mentioned it feels that in a way away from the rest of the world, right? But what is it about Nashville and then more specifically the Weirdo Workshop that makes it so appealing to artists?
For us, what's that? Because what attracted Nashville, what attracted us to Nashville was the songwriting reverence.
Right. Okay, I see that. Yeah.
So we considered everywhere. Well, we considered a lot of places. We considered Austin, Texas. We considered Denver. There's different places that we considered, outside of coming to Nashville. But there was a sense of, man, this is a place that really respects and cares about song craft and songwriting. We didn't get that. That's not something you get a sense of in Atlanta. That's not the something you get the sense of in LA. It's not the something you get the sense of in New York. You know that this place in Nashville is almost like an institution of song craft. And we know what our contribution and ability is in that manner, and what we're doing with Weirdo Workshop and the songs that we're the artists are releasing through Weirdo Workshop and what we're intending to do with Weirdo Workshop song wise. We felt that Nashville was the perfect home for that.
And then since you've been there,
That
sign
and
Avery Wilson.
huh?
I was saying since you've been there, you've signed Avery Wilson, which is a massive look.
Yeah,
How did that
yeah.
happen?
How did Avery happen? So there's been certain artists that we always had our eye on,
Yeah.
and I think Chuck and Claude have always had their eye on. Like say right now with Avery, I think it was just one of those relationships and one of those things that's happened at the right time, and also what he's looking for. I think he's just looking for someone to work with and get really good music and get a really good song, to put out new music with, as he's embarking on the current and next phase, what he's establishing right now in the next phase of his career. And so that came about really based off the music, from my perspective. First few songs that we did, just seemed so very special, and seemed like the right thing to do.
Makes sense. And so you are an exec there, right? And
Yes.
so when you are looking at artists, what are the things which stand out for you? So, for example, actually, better question. If somebody wanted to work with Weirdo Workshop, right, who do they need to be to impress Mike Guru Johnson?
I love originality.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I champion and we've established here, is that we're about originality. I think it's special when, because the reason why I say originality is such a foundation, if you found a sense of originality that's good, there's only two types of music, right? Good and bad. So if you establish a certain type of good music that's a there's a originality into it, I feel like you've one, you're a student, two, you've found enough to be able to flesh out either you're working with the right people to help you along the way, or you found the way to lean into the unique aspects of yourself and perfect that and present that in a great, in a honest way that shines originality. I think that's a strong point. I
That
think
makes a lot of sense. And so,
musicality,
sorry, sorry, go on.
taste is important.
Taste, right.
I think taste is one of the key factors because, yeah, just taste. Because that's all your application goals. You apply taste to your application
Fair
and
enough.
the
Okay.
output of what you're doing is reflective of your taste.
Okay, and then where are you finding? So are you looking for new artists? And if you are looking, where are you looking?
So we're not necessarily like the label with your regular model where okay we need to sign X amount of artists and you need to release X amount of releases, you know, et cetera. You know, that's not our business model. One end partially coming to the amount of investment that's taken into artist development. You can't just spread that across anywhere. You got to do it where it matters. So, but also, for newer artists, like, because we are definitely, I think that's also just about intentions and sounds. Like, I think what I'm most interested in, what we're most interested in, one of the things most interested in right now is finding something along the Southern Soul Blues lane, you know. Like, I think that's the thing we're most attracted to. Like, one, I grew up with that music. You know, I'm from Mississippi. I grew up and you know, that's our music. You know, like, you know, blues, we created blues, you know, Southern Soul, something that's kind of like a subgenre in a way that's kind of developed from it. But it's actually a movement right now. And I'm like,
Okay.
man, hey. I know that we can do that. I know that music inside and out. Chuck knows that music inside and out. Claus, he's more new to it and discovered it, but he loves it inside and out. You know, so I like in my mind, this is the next. Unless there's something else that kind of comes and makes this case, like I think this is the world that we're looking toward. That's a direction, you know that we're looking to find some good cool things, you know. Like I found out about an artist named King George that I really love, you know.
George, okay.
And he's that's a certain approach too. Like I think it's also about like when it comes to taste, because there's certain types of songs that you can make in that blues world, Southern Soul world that, you know, if you could come off across a really good resonating song that could be timeless, you know, in that field, you know. So I really want to do something in that lane,
Right.
you know, represent that world. You know, if I kind of look at like, man, we got this great thing going, you know, we've established with Weirdo Workshop, you know, now, how could I not? You know, how can I not funnel something in that? You know, so I'm actually open to things coming from Mississippi too, you know, or in that Arkansas, you know, Memphis, Georgia, Alabama area, you know, like New Orleans. I would love to find some, you know, someone that's coming from that region. That's the real deal.
And so if someone is unfamiliar with that sound, right, are there any artists who, let's say, are like popular now, who you'd say in some respects that are already making something similar?
Not yet, not right now. Like,
Wow.
it's not because the thing is that even like with Southern Soul and Blues, even here in the States, like, it's more regional because it's a cultural thing. Like I said, that's part. It's a music of my culture in Mississippi, and of course the South. So, the relatability of it in the
I
past
see.
didn't really reach. You know, the East Coast or the West Coast too much. I'm sure it did because it's black and it's all across all African Americans in America. We all have an
Ancestral, like link to the south.
special, relatability to the sound. You know what I mean? I think that's why Snoop Dogg really relates to it. And he also really loves guy King George, but you'll see him posting and singing his songs on his social media and all the time. But so I think it's something that's too new to be discovered, but it's not so. It's the heart of America's music, man. Like there wouldn't be any music without blues, without first Negro spiritual, without first gospel music. You know, this stuff is the heart of soul music. You know what I mean? So if you want to pick it up and hear it from anything like that, anything that stems from that, whether rock and roll or whether
Absolutely.
R&B, so like there's something that's they wouldn't have the idea first
Wow.
before if it wasn't for this. This was the this rep the representation started here.
Yeah, that's
You
amazing.
know, so I mean, but it's still certain sounds like like Johnny Taylor. There's no Johnny Taylors today. You know, you can go look him up, you know.
Okay.
A lot of different things. A lot of different things that, you know, your favorite bands of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame were inspired on, you
Right.
know. And I think that there could be, we think that there could be a resurgence of it. That's already a movement. Like these artists, it's already a movement. It's a movement. Like these artists are they could do a whole arena show if it get coordinated right. You know, you could have a whole arena show with the right artists if you get coordinated right. You know what I mean? And those are those type of festivals and things that are happening where these artists are performing. That's a circuit, you know, where it's already happening. It's just not like, okay, it's not on in the pop music lens,
I see.
you
Yeah,
know.
but I say the best things that happen in music are movements where it starts as something is touring, something is moving, and then it builds an organic fan base and then builds that way.
Yep.
Well,
Yep.
my honestly, this has been extremely insightful. I've known you for what, about 6 or 7 years now, but I've learned so much more about your journey and the way the workshop journey and just about your impact in popular music. So if someone is tuning in and wants to learn more about you, where can they find you?
I'm on socials, Mike Guru Johnson. Usually that's my social on Instagram, Twitter. I would say if you want to learn more about me, Google Mike Track Guru Johnson or Google Mike Guru Johnson. You know, there's a lot of things out
Mike Track Johnson.
there. Yeah. That's TRAKGURU. There's a lot of things out there. As my credits and things like that, you can go back and listen to different songs and stuff like that I've been a part of. Other than that, follow the Weirdo Workshop movement. You know, follow what's happening with Lewis York. Follow what's happening with the Shindellas. Follow what's happening with We Sound Crazy podcast. Follow what's happening with Kim Nicky. Kim Nicky is another example. Exactly what I'm talking about, as far as like, she's not blues, Southern soul, but she's blues. She's a rock and roll soul. Like she's like, Muddy Waters. Look him up if you ever heard of him. Muddy Waters had a song called "The Blues Had a Baby and They Named Him Rock and Roll."
Okay.
That's what Kim Nicky is.
I
So.
see.
Super excited about her. Follow what follow Avery Wilson and Kiss the Sky. We got more coming with him, you know. Got a lot of great things that we're I can look at, you know, our roster as we're the workshop. I'm very proud of it. You know, it's from corner to corner. You know, that's and I think that's how you do it. You know, you don't have no why have what why have things that just taking up space, just be taking up space, you know.
Bro, it's amazing, man. Well, Mike, I'm gonna love you and leave you. I look forward to seeing what you, I mean, I know what you guys are working on, but I look forward to the world seeing it because there's a lot to come.
Yeah, man.
Right, bro.
Yes.
Great day,
Thank
man.
you so much. Thank you so much for extending this and having me on for me to share this. I really appreciate you.
Course. Listen, bro, you've worked on so many amazing things, and I think with this platform, my goal is to celebrate the people who Do the work you know, but you may not know yourself. So honestly, man, my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for all that you're doing too. Us with us. You're right here with us on the Real Workshop team in my eyes.
Right, thanks, man. Thank you so much. Have a nice day, yeah?
Yeah, you too.
Best work. See you.